5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
All right, lift off and the clock has started. Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear.
Ask a rocket scientist.
7 year fuel is go 4G. 5.5 cabin. Oxygen go. All systems are go.
Welcome to this edition of Ask a Rocket Scientist. My name is Chuck Woodford, and I'm an idiot. And I'm joined by my rocket science pal, Bill Scaff. Say hi, Bill.
Hey, Chuck. How you doing?
Doing just fine. So the reason for the podcast is I'm really not that bright when it comes to scientific things. And I need things explained to me in a super simplistic manner. And Bill is incredibly good at talking to my 12-year-old brain when it comes to scientific things. So I've asked Bill to join me to help answer some of life's and science's biggest questions and some of the more simple stuff that we encounter on a day-to-day basis. So hence the reason for the podcast. So Bill, first question that I've got is I was surfing the internet and I see that by the end of this year, 2018, Joe and Jane Average could be flying into space.
They could.
I saw this article in Gadget.com, which said that Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos's thing, the guy that runs Amazon, he's now trying to get us into space as well, could be flying by the end of the year.
They could, and they've been actually slowly working towards this without a lot of publicity in the media. I think I read they just had their 8th rocket test in a what essentially is a tourism configuration that they'll take you to the edge of space. So
what does that
mean? So you're not going to go into orbit around the Earth. You're going to go straight up to 300,000 feet or thereabouts, and then come straight back down. But you'll get a few minutes of weightlessness in the process.
So what is the 300,000? What'd you say?
300,000 feet.
300,000 feet. What happens at that point? Why is that considered space?
It's considered basically the edge of the atmosphere, where after that the atmosphere basically disappears. We've considered that the edge of space for quite some time. So even back in the 60s when the X-15 pilots were flying, when they cleared 300,000 feet, you know, NASA said, hey, you were now astronauts, and they got astronaut wings.
If you watch that classic movie, The Right Stuff,
exactly.
You see the pilots are desperately trying to get to that altitude. And
I don't know if they had any X-15 pilots. I think they do briefly. Mm-hmm. I think that is in there. And one of them actually, unfortunately, comes apart in the attempt to get up there, but that's part of that movie.
It was not an easy task to accomplish.
No,
it's
not.
Back in the 40s and 50s when they were trying.
No, even today getting to 300,000 feet isn't a trivial task. You know, that's
which is why we haven't done it yet.
Exactly. We don't commonly go up there.
So, okay, so let's talk about that experience. Let's say you can afford the $900 million or whatever it's going to cost.
Six figures. I think they're saying six figures between.
Like $100,000 or $900,000?
Right. No, like $100,000. Like even Virgin Galactic's in the same mix for taking people to the edge of space. And I think they're saying between $100,000 and $250,000 is the price to go for the ride.
Okay, so let's say we've got $200,000 burning a hole in our pocket and we want to go to space. What does that get me? Now, and would Blue Origin be the same as a Virgin Intergalactic, because there's several different companies that are doing space tourism, right?
Right. The two biggies are, as I said, Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic. They use different vehicles. Virgin Galactic is more of an aircraft-style vehicle. Gets flown up to 40,000 feet underneath a larger aircraft. It drops them. They light an engine. They fire up to 300,000 feet.
Got it.
And you get about 3 minutes of weightlessness up there. Blue Origin is a rocket, a true rocket with a capsule on top. Now, the capsule has these giant bay windows wrapping all around you. It does the same thing. It'll shoot you straight up to 300,000 feet. You get your few minutes of weightlessness. You come back down. Now, the difference between a normal rocket is, you know, when you launch, you're trying to get into orbit. So you start tipping eastward and putting yourself in a circular orbit.
Yeah.
These vehicles do not do that. They go basically straight up and they come straight back down to where you started from.
Oh, okay.
So it's a different business model, so to speak, to enable the tourism aspect.
So I'm spending $200,000 for 25 minutes, 2 hours,
not
4 days.
Bad. You'll be, I'd like to think there's some training involved. I'd like to think you show up a day or two early, get a little bit of basic training.
Yeah. Keep dreaming.
You've got to be wearing a pressure suit. If you depressurize up there, you're dead. Right?
Bad news.
You'll be wearing gear. So there's got to be some training involved.
Okay.
Let's take the Blue Origin vehicle, for example. It's a true rocket. It's got a capsule. You are harnessed in for the launch up, but you'll get up there in a number of minutes, right? It doesn't take very long to get up there on a rocket.
Okay.
You will separate the pod, the top, the capsule you're in, and they've got these beautiful bay windows. They say they'll let you unharness, float around for the 3 minutes, get up against the windows, you know, enjoy your time in orbit or pseudo orbit, strap back in and come straight back down.
Huh.
And in that case, the return is much like, you know, the Apollo missions or any other space mission. You're going to come down, parachutes come out.
Got it.
Land.
But will the return be like we see in the movies when the Apollo craft comes in and you're entering Earth's atmosphere and just all the heat and you need heat shields and, or are you not high up enough for that to be an issue?
And you're basically not coming in fast either, so there's not the heat generation. And I should clarify, I'm not positive whether that Blue Origin's actually going to separate the capsule, because we've seen their rocket can land itself.
Mm-hmm. Which is amazing
which
to
is
watch.
Just killer cool.
It's so great.
Between that and SpaceX bringing rockets home, it's killer cool.
Super cool.
So I haven't actually seen, you know, do they keep the capsule on top and bring the whole rocket down, or do they separate the rocket land separately from the capsule?
Yeah.
So that's something I haven't seen yet.
Okay. So, well, all right, then let me ask this. Okay. So what you're saying is that you've got a couple days training ahead of time, or weeks training, whatever it is, but the actual amount of time you're sitting in the rocket, lift off, you go up, you say you're only weightless for a couple minutes, probably then they bring you back down.
Yeah. You're probably done it in less than an hour.
So less than an hour, the whole thing.
Half an hour, maybe.
200 grand spent. Yep. In rocket fuel to get you up and back.
Yep.
So why are they technologically able to keep us up there longer? Like, could they just stay in that stasis point for 2 or 3 hours, 5 hours, and just let us hang up out there, have a meal, you know, and see the Earth kind of rotate under us? Or is there a reason why it's just a quick little foot? Okay, you're back.
Right. It's a cost kind of issue and a complexity. So to stay up there longer, you've got to go in orbit. Going in orbit is significantly more difficult than going to 300,000 feet.
Got it.
So you're looking at, again, complexity, costs, life support systems. Everything gets
ratcheted up tremendously.
Exponentially more difficult and more expensive.
Got
to get into true orbit.
Got it.
Would you go is the question.
No, not for such a short amount of time.
Right.
Like
it's a good question.
If I were given the opportunity to go into space, like I could, you know, I could get a ride on the Vomit Comet if I wanted to be weightless.
If you want weightless, you can do it in many ways.
Yeah, because I've seen, you know, video of that, footage of that, where, you know, pilots and astronauts and the cast of Apollo 13 got to go on the Air Force plane and achieve weightlessness.
That was pretty amazing.
And so if I'm just going to be weightless and to be high in the sky, I want perspective. Mm-hmm. I want to see the big blue marble underneath me, and I want to watch it rotate. And I want to, because the footage that we see from the International Space Station is it flies over the Earth at night, and you just see little pockets of lights, and then you see the sun. That's what I want.
Yeah.
So barring me losing 200 pounds and gaining the ability to join NASA or whoever's going to be sending astronauts up to the space station or wherever we're sending them, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that, because I would. That's what I'd like to do. Yes.
Well, that's not out of the question. It's just not around right now, because there's been some articles about the Russians building a true for hire small space station that you can have to find a ride up there, which is a great segue, because the two commercial low Earth orbit companies are coming in line for the first test flights in 2018 as well. You got SpaceX with their Mandragon, and you have Boeing with their CTS-100.
Oh, hi, Marlin.
And we got astronaut Marlin here.
Marlin the kitty has joined us.
That's right. If there's tuna in space, he's there. And Ham.
Fantastic. Hi, Marlin. Good kitty.
But those two companies were part of the NASA's efforts to transition low Earth orbit delivery systems to commercial companies.
Got it.
For-profit companies.
And also to get people to the space station, right?
Right, exactly. It's again, low Earth orbit, they're seeding that to commercial companies, and the space station is in low Earth orbit.
Yeah.
That frees up NASA to go back after the bigger picture missions like space exploration and interplanetary efforts. So Boeing and SpaceX will be space taxis.
Got it.
First test flights in 2018 for both of them. And with those around, if the Russians put up this little tourism station hotel, I mean, you could easily book yourself a shot on a SpaceX Mandragon, say, I want to go to the Russian station, leave me there for a week.
Okay, sign me up for that.
You can. So these things,
I would absolutely do that in a heartbeat, assuming I, you know, could afford it and it was an opportunity presented.
And another.
Would you?
You know, I'd be, wow.
Because this is your life. Your whole life
I build these things.
Yes, you do.
But I think that makes me both the best and the worst person, because then I know what's going on behind the scenes.
Yes.
So
I failed to mention at the beginning that Bill is literally a rocket scientist. He's working on the Orion craft.
I am.
To get us to Mars.
Well, and beyond, point. Yeah.
And beyond. Beyond. So those are his rocket science bona fides. Or bona fides. Is it bona fides?
Gosh,
let's go with bona fides. Sounds a lot less pretentious. So would you go?
You know, I'd want to, but I think I'd be a nervous wreck, to be honest. And I worked in the aircraft industry for quite a long time, too, and I'm not necessarily the best flyer, even though I know how much effort and redundancy is in a commercial airplane. I still don't
you
like it when
you
hit big bumps.
Not helping me at all.
No. Well, that's
when
the thing.
I travel on a plane. Now, if Bill,
no,
who's
I'm
worked in the aerospace industry.
No. Hang on. I didn't say I'm afraid of crashing. I just said I didn't like the turbulence, the bumps.
Okay, even though you probably have a better understanding as to what's happening on that plane and why it's safe.
I do.
Than anybody else. But yet still, it... Yeah. This isn't helping at all because I talked myself into being an
astronaut just now.
No. To be a person on a plane that doesn't freak out. But now that I know that you, Bill, this isn't helping.
It's a different freak out. Different freak out.
Okay.
And I can say I've actually truly been upside down in commercial airplanes supporting a flight test when I worked at Boeing. You know, you have to test them in every way possible before you ever let a paying passenger on them. And mm-hmm. So they have to fly the plane in every condition that they say it can get out of and that the FAA requires, which includes all the things that simulate the plane being in a horribly off nominal day.
Let's just take a moment and appreciate what Bill just said. He has been in a commercial airplane upside down.
I have. 737, fully inverted.
How high off the ground?
We were at 30,000 feet doing flight test maneuvers. But I've been through, you name it, I've been in it.
Okay.
I've lost my lunch way too many times supporting a flight test.
All these tales will be told in future podcasts. Okay, so let's put a button on the space tourism thing for now.
Okay.
So what we're hearing is that by the end of this year, by the end of 2018, supposedly somebody might be taking commercial passengers up. They're or at least doing test flights to see if they can get
humans,
me and you into space.
Exactly. Humans will be on board. Both SpaceX and Boeing are actually going to be flying with astronauts this year.
Got it.
So those are test flights, right? They're not paying public on those flights. It's actually a professional astronaut and a flight test pilot from the parent company. So Boeing has its own pilot as well.
So everything going well, this could literally be a thing in the next year or two.
Most definitely. Yeah.
That's remarkable.
Depending on how much you want to spend,
well, you
can go.
Let's see how successful this podcast is. Maybe that'll fund my trip to the Russian space station.
For now, we'll be happy to get to Pueblo. But, you know.
Exactly. Yes.
It's pretty spacey.
Well, thanks for the info on that one, Bill. All right, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back here in just a moment with our next question. This episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist is brought to you by Banana Bread. I know what you're thinking, banana bread. You think initially it's like, oh, banana in bread? But then you have a bite, like a really good piece of banana bread. Oh, God, there's nothing better, right? I mean, it's like it just dissolves in your mouth and there's just it can't be too chunky, though. I mean, you can't have chunks of banana. It's, banana bread. Okay, now back to Ask a Rocket Scientist. Okay, this is part of the show I like to call Science or Poppycock. It's an opportunity for Bill and I to discuss the way that science is depicted in the arts in particular and movies that I like to sit and watch. This is the 50th anniversary of the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece that came out in April of 1968. And I just sat down and watched it recently, and it's still blowing my mind 50 years after its release. And so one thing I want to talk about with you, Bill, is it kind of blew my mind how accurately the creators of this movie got the future. Like how accurate they were in depicting certain technologies. Now, some of them they missed the boat completely, which I'm sure we'll get into as well. But it's really impressive seeing, you know, the way that they would depict 2001 and how it actually ended up turning out.
So if you want to think about, you know, things we take as commonplace every day, flat screen TVs, you know, it actually was really impressive to me that in the movie they depict seatback entertainment units, sort of like an iPad. They had a reading, you know, where they're watching TV on a little flat screen portable device. The cockpits in all the ships, flat screen, digital avionics. You know, maybe not, you know, quite as they manifested today, but the concepts were all correct. You know, when you talk about things they got right, they definitely got that right. the part of it that they didn't quite get right is they're still button-based. They didn't foresee touch screens.
Oh, interesting.
Because nowhere do they touch a screen. They're all surrounded by buttons to interact with the screen. So, so I give them, you know, that's a very solid 50% on you know, on the concept of how we interact with our iPads today.
Yes.
But like you said, they didn't have any of this to go on. You know, they think about TV then, they barely had color TV.
Right.
Right. And let alone, and in the movie, everything's color. Everything, you know, it's everything was way beyond, which I found very fantastic. And yeah, it also opens up that question is like, did the movie inspire these technologies?
Sure.
Don't know. But it could have been someone saw it and said, hey.
That's a debate that's been raging ever since the handheld phone was equated to Star Trek. The handheld communicators.
Like
you can look at the communicators and you realize that whether Steve Jobs was truly motivated by Star Trek or whether that was just in the back of his mind, there's some design elements that are very similar there.
Exactly. Great analogy.
And so, so as far as, you know, the interaction and I love the scene where Haywood Floyd is calling back home. He's missed his son's birthday.
Or his daughter's birthday.
His daughter's birthday, and they're having a little communication, and there's just a slight delay because he's on his way to the moon at that point, or he's at the moon.
Let me think about that. I think he's on the space station.
So what happens is there's a Haywood Floyd's a scientist, doctor, and he travels from Earth to the space station, the space station to the moon, where they've made this amazing discovery. And in future episodes, we'll talk about the monolith, and we'll talk about the impact of the whole mythology behind 2001. But here, nuts and bolts, the scene where he's sitting talking to his daughter on the space vid screen.
The vid screen, of course, now we have FaceTime.
Yes.
See, that was another one I got right.
Yeah. So I wonder if can you FaceTime to the International Space Station? Like, can we make a FaceTime connection?
You know, I would imagine they have Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's another thing they got right.
Don't know if it's LTE, but yeah, I think you probably could.
That's another thing they got right. And so, okay, so I'm going to defer to you as far as the technology of spacecrafts.
Ah, this is an interesting one.
Because when you see them going to the space station, you see that they are walking around with Velcro shoes so that they can stay on the ground. There's a scene where just a pen is casually floating in the air because of the anti-gravity. There's no gravity.
Let's touch on this as the movie progresses. The first thing you see is they're going up to orbit on kind of an orbital space plane. You know, it's Pan Am Airways, right?
Yes.
Which was an awesome way to say
this. Which goes back to our Blue Origin.
Kind of. And the thinking there is that it's become so easy or so commonplace, it's just a commercial airline that is now also providing space travel. So it's the segue back to, or forward to, Blue Origin and
SpaceX,
Galactic, SpaceX, Boeing, right?
Yeah.
Now, what they depict as a single stage to orbit is kind of a catchphrase that came up in the 80s when Reagan wanted a plane that could do this, which means you don't need a rocket. You're not throwing away stages of rockets to get the orbit. It's just a single vehicle can fly straight up, straight back down.
Yeah.
We haven't gotten there. We still haven't gotten to that. So that part is a dream. Really cool idea. It hasn't quite gotten there. But like you said, inside the plane, flat screen TVs, they're all harnessed in. It's weightless. You know, they're still functioning.
Yeah.
You know, like pretty much what you'd expect today if we were to fly to a space station, albeit they did it much faster because you don't want to wait, you know, for a 3-hour docking maneuver.
Right.
The space station they go to in low Earth orbit is a spinning circular space station, and that's how they're providing the artificial gravity, because in those scenes in the space station, they're walking normally.
Yes.
It's not weightless.
True.
Because the spinning device creates the gravity.
So let's talk about that for a moment, because if you remember at the beginning of the podcast when I said I'm an idiot, this is one of those examples why. Okay, so the spinning space station creates gravity. How? Does it have to spin at a certain rotation? Okay.
It's a certain rotation relative to the radius of the portion of the space station you're standing in. So we've all swung a tennis ball around that's on a string, and you can feel it pulling back on you. Well, you're pulling back on it, right, to keep it from flying off. Well, the acceleration due to that spinning creates that force that you feel in the string, and that's, from the ball's perspective, that's gravity, right? Something's holding it back.
Yeah.
Right. So you are the tennis ball in the analogy of the space station, right? You're being flung around by the space station spinning.
Got it.
And pretty simplistically, your acceleration, I'm going to throw a little math at you, it's the speed that you're moving squared divided by the radius.
Okay.
Right. So
that doesn't make any sense to me, but I'm sure somebody listening right now is like, yes, Bill, that's very accurate.
It's centripetal acceleration. I know what that is.
Oh, acceleration.
Centripetal. We're geeking out a minute here, but
yeah, you go right ahead. I'm just going to sit here and observe. It's fun to watch.
You can calculate that, you know, given a radius, you can figure out how fast you need to be going to match Earth's gravity or any amount of gravity. And actually, that was a lot of foresight on Stanley Kubrick's part, because we've learned that if you put people in true weightlessness for too long, bad things happen to the human body, because it really was not designed for zero G.
Right.
You know, your bones.
Did we learn that recently with the International Space Station, with one of the Kelly brothers when he was up there for the full year?
We learned
year?
A lot from that.
Yeah.
That was
Mark
a, that
Kelly
was,
and Scott Kelly.
Scott and Mark. Scott was in orbit. Mark was still on ground, if
Got
I remember
it.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's your best test case, right? They're both astronauts. They have identical DNA. And then you can track what changed over the 1 year's time.
And we noticed there were some serious noticeable mm-hmm. changes.
There were. Even some DNA alterations.
Yeah.
Because you're being exposed to radiation, you know, up in low Earth, greater radiation, I should say, in low Earth orbit than you are on Earth.
And so what you're saying is interesting is the fact that Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, back in the mid-60s when they were putting this together, they knew that.
They did.
And they knew that there would need to be some kind of gravity.
I think they were guessing, right? Because the movie was made before we'd even made it.
Sure.
You know, Apollo was still trying to get to the moon. But the hypothesis is, well, the human body, given long enough times in zero-G, what we've learned now, and that they didn't quite know then, was your bones immediately begin to decalcify and weaken because you don't need them in space, right?
Right.
I saw
Wall-E. Did you see Wall-E?
Joel,
everybody turns into a big gelatinous blob at the end of the movie because they're not
rascals
moving.
Driving around the ship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember. Pixar taught me that lesson years ago.
Man, they got it. They got it down.
Nailed it.
Yeah, it's like, boom.
but then, okay, so that's that's in the space station. Now let's get to Frank Poole and Dave Bowman on the actual ship.
On Discovery 1.
On Discovery, mm-hmm. which is traveling to Jupiter to go find the anomaly that's out.
And so they touch on some faves from science fiction. Now, first off, they also have a spinner inside the ship, so they have gravity.
Yes.
So they're not having
There's that great scene where Bowman's jogging.
Yeah.
And the camera tracks with him. How great was that shot?
That was amazing.
God, it's just incredible how they were able to get that back in the 1960s.
And I think that was one of the largest rotating sets ever built.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Just for that
super
shot.
Cool. Just for that. Which made it worth it.
Yeah. Because I think that's the first time you see the space station, and that's how Kubrick reveals their environment. Because as the camera goes, you get to see each sarcophagus for the three astronauts that are in suspended animation or whatever it is.
Exactly.
You get to see all that, and you get to see Hal on the side. You get to see his eye as Bowman's running, and it's such a great establishing shot to show you what this environment is.
And the scale that they're going to live in.
Yeah.
They never actually talk about how long it takes to get to Jupiter. I've been curious, given... Because we know now it would take a long time. And that's part of the reason why they have... So on a good day, it would take you about 6 months to get to Mars.
Yeah.
And that's optimal alignment of Mars to Earth. Now, Jupiter's about 10 times, it's over 10 times further from Earth than Mars is, right? Yeah. So if it took 6 months to get to Mars, you're looking at...
Right. Five, 6 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then we've learned from our sending satellites and probes out that far that... you can gain a little time by slingshotting, you know, going the wrong direction, the slingshotting around the sun, getting a little more speed and getting out there. So maybe we can shorten it up a bit, but still, it's a long flight.
Yeah. So the assumption that we make with 2001 is that Bowman and Poole, you have to assume that they were in suspended animation as well, as opposed to being awake for 5 years.
You'd have to wonder about that. They don't really talk about
it. Yeah, it's not really explained in the movie.
They never touch on that. And there's reasons or ulterior reasons why the other three scientists are in suspended animation, depending on if you've read the book or what you interpret the movie to mean.
Yeah. What you've read some psychotic write on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. There's all sorts of theories about that one. It's kind of cool they do touch on suspended animation, though, because you got to figure 5 years of food and water is an extraordinary amount of food and water.
Yeah.
And spaceships have to be light. Right. So you couldn't feed somebody for that long and pack that much food in there. So,
and you also wouldn't want the psychological strain on two guys, two strapping dudes hanging out on an air, hanging out on a spaceship all by themselves for 5 years. They would murder each other.
You're telling me that Hal wouldn't have been used for the above-the-table video shows that we were seeing.
I would not have survived 6 months together.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting topic, because there's been a lot of studies about what happens when you lock people into a confined space for extended periods of time. It is a challenge with spaceflight.
Yeah. Well, I've seen all the horror movies. They end up murdering each other.
Right.
There's no question
there's
there.
There's no option to be here.
Yeah, that's how that ends.
Yeah, you slip your soup too loud. Someone's going to beat you over the head with a fire extinguisher. at that point in time.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would do with you.
Of course.
I mean,
of course.
Let's be real here.
Well, I mean, Sandra Bullock didn't have any beat over the head with her fire extinguisher. She just used it to fly around space. Yeah.
Let's not start talking about gravity.
Nope.
That'll be our next episode.
The poppycock factor there is pretty high.
Yeah, but it's a great
fun movie, though.
Oh,
I did enjoy it.
Okay, so as far as 2001 goes, and like I say, this movie is so dense and so rich, we will come back to revisit so many different aspects of it in future podcasts. But as far as what they got right and what they got wrong, they got an awful lot right.
I leaned towards the right.
And they didn't necessarily... Right. Did they get anything wrong, or did they just not know?
I think...
Like your comment about so many buttons, they didn't necessarily get that wrong about
wrong.
The future.
It was just their perception
they
of
just
the future.
They just didn't see that.
Right. They didn't. I mean, you think about it. HAL was monstrosity of a computer. They completely missed the miniaturization of computers.
They sure did. Yeah, because
so HAL
HAL's a gigantic.
He is massive. He's probably most of that ship.
Yeah,
you know, when you look
yeah.
at that boom that goes behind the ship.
Yeah. Okay, so a lot of good science in 2001, not a lot of poppycock.
Not much.
Fantastic. All right, we'll take another break, and we'll be back in just a moment. This episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist brought to you by scratching your foot. You know, when it's really itchy, I don't know if you get athlete's foot or you get like a little something where it's just... You just get in there. You just start, and you know you're not supposed to. It's just going to make it worse, right? You're going to open it up. It's just, it's not going to, the end result is not going to be great. But when you're doing it, oh, you're the scratching your foot feels so good. Okay, back to the episode. Okay, for the final segment of the podcast, this is where we open it up to you, the listener. You get to ask a rocket scientist a question, and you can do so at our website, iHeartRocketScience.com. And that's actually, you spell out the word heart, iHeartRocketScience.com. You can leave us a question there. I think you're able to shoot a little video and post it there, whatever. You know, you can record a comment, send it to us. However you want to get us the information, just ask your questions, and Bill and I will address them in upcoming episodes. So Rena Campbell from Chicago has a very good question, which kind of relates to our 2001 conversation, is that why don't we know what's on every single celestial body in the solar system? Why haven't we landed on Pluto and Neptune and Io and all the moons of Saturn and Jupiter? And why haven't we landed on, you know, Venus? Why haven't we just taken ships and sent off little, not humans, but just little explorers? Because it brings this up. I was watching the classic show Cosmos, the Carl Sagan version. And he actually, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s when they put this together, he, you know, one of the episodes was like, we don't know what's on the moon Titan. We don't know what it's made of. And it occurred to me, it's like, why not? Why haven't we landed crafts on all these bodies circling the sun just to find out what's there?
And I think that's a good question. You know, the natural curiosity, because when you think about humans, I mean, we're explorers.
Yeah.
Scattered all over the earth.
At
some point, we wanted to see what was out there.
Yeah.
When it comes to space, two basic tenets of space. A, it's very difficult, and B, it's very expensive.
Sure.
So to the extent that would we like to, I'm sure we'd like to send something, you know, probe everywhere. Is it feasible or have something that we think we could learn from it? Then you have to start, you know, justifying a little bit. If you take your difficult extremes, Mercury, way too close to the sun, way too hot, right?
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't get something that close to survive very long. So, okay, so we'll
okay, so same. Okay, so Mercury is so close,
right,
that
it's the closest planet to the
that
sun.
We don't have the capability of sending something to Mercury that would survive the intense heat.
Right. At least not for very long. I mean, we could probably get something in there, but I don't know what.
And do we know, is it solid? Is it molten? Is Mercury, do we know that?
I don't know.
So let's go.
So find out. You can see it though, and it doesn't appear to be, I don't know, it doesn't a molten blob of fluid.
Exactly.
So it seems like it's right.
Got it.
So, you know, I believe it's solid. We could land on it if we could survive the temperature.
Who wants to?
All right. I mean, you're not going to find, you know, daisies popping up on Mercury. It's
but,
just not. But still, you're
but
right. There's a cool factor.
We
What's
are
the,
curious.
Is it just under the surface, you know, chock full of, you know, platinum or some material that
exactly.
can survive the heat? I don't know.
And, you know, I not to answer my own question or to usurp the rocket scientist, but I think it comes down to the same reason why we're not on the moon. It's because we didn't find anything there that's worth any money. Like, we didn't find, there's no reason for us to spend crazy amounts of money to go to these places if we can't truly exploit all the resources right. and make a boatload of cash doing it.
Sadly, science does
is
have
that
a commercial aspect.
Is that the,
No, I mean, it's the thing. When you're putting big money on the line, it's you have to have a reason. It doesn't necessarily have to be that it's
ROI,
gonna make you,
the return on your investment.
Well, it doesn't have to be that, because it could also be science. It could be, you know, there's many, many
sure.
ways to justify this. It's just not that every one of these bodies necessarily has something that we could learn from it. And then you even look at the gas giants. We couldn't land on anyway. You can't land in gas, right?
Okay, so let's talk about that. So Saturn, Jupiter.
Right, they're gas balls, right?
And so there literally is nothing at the core of these planets that is solid enough for us to touch down on.
I think, I believe there is, but the problem is getting there, because for gas to be compressed hard enough to appear like a planet, right, it gets pretty darn dense, right? Okay. So you probably crushed by pressure long before you got.
So you're in essence flying through. It's like when you get ice cream and you put that syrup on the ice cream that hardens immediately. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
the magic shell.
Magic shell, that's it.
Yeah, so that's what it is. It's a magic shell of gas.
Kind of.
Surrounding. See, you got to put it in food terms. Right. That's how I understand.
Right. Well, we've all been in the ocean, right? Where you go deep enough that you know the pressure builds on your ears, and you have to pop your ears pop as you go down.
Sure. Well, or climbing a mountain, or riding the mountains here in Colorado.
Exactly. Yes. Uh-huh. So it's a similar idea, right? The deeper you go on a gas ball, the more pressure is going to build until the point where you just you get crushed.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like we always see that in the movies with deep sea movies like The Abyss. You go down too deep, you're going to get crushed.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Same thing. It's just a gas form instead of a liquid form.
Okay.
So there's some planets that, okay, yeah, we could probably get to them. In fact, we've flown by them, but...
Could we fly into the gas?
I would think so.
The outer shell, in essence, the outer layers of the gas, just to... Okay. Because
I would think so.
And again, to Rena's point, I just want to know. And I think the scientific community wants to know. It's like, okay, what is happening on Jupiter? What's that swirling eye? Is that truly the largest storm? Like that storm is larger than how many Earths? Like that circle on Jupiter is so large, it'll take an obscene amount of Earths to fill that thing up. That's how big it is. And that's so incomprehensible. I want to know what's in there. What's going on?
Yeah. You can be the first weatherman on... on another planet.
Okay, so let's get Blue Origin going. Let me get up first and see if I can stomach getting into space. So
if you can handle 300,000 feet, then we'll talk about the years it's going to take to get out to...
Yeah, the 7 years it'll take to get to Jupiter.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So,
okay.
But along the lines of getting somewhere faster, New Horizons launched in 2008. That's the probe we sent. It wasn't intended to land anywhere. And this is just such on something you asked earlier, why haven't we landed? Getting there on a flyby is infinitely easier than trying to land because you're coasting, right? You're just carrying speed, you're whizzing by your target, get all the pictures you can, and then keep on going.
Got it.
The minute you need to land, you need to slow down. You need a lot more fuel, your engine has to be able to stop you, land you.
Got it.
Infinitely more difficult, more expensive, more complex mission. So a lot of the times on these outer planets, we just fly by. Mm-hmm. Now, New Horizons launched in 2008, and Pluto is way out there. And even if we don't consider Pluto a planet anymore...
Still want to know what it is.
We still want to know what it is.
Still want to go see it.
And the goal was New Horizons' goal. Its primary, I guess you want to call it, science mission was to capture Pluto, but they never intended to put it into orbit. It's going to go. Its intent is to get out of the solar system. Mm-hmm. So to give you an idea how fast that thing's humming along, Apollo took 2.5 days to get to the moon.
Yes.
Right. New Horizons went past the moon in 6 hours.
6 hours.
Fastest object we've ever launched. I think right now they say it's moving at about 85,000 miles an hour.
And so the speed that it had as it passed the moon, it has maintained that speed.
It's actually gotten greater because we slingshot
it. It's going faster now.
We actually did several slingshots to gain even more speed. So it is. Great. That's what I'm saying. Now I think they said it's moving at 85,000. I want to say it's 85,000 miles an hour. I could be wrong on that. It's just a recollection.
Yeah.
It is winging out there.
It's hauling.
Yeah, it's already passed. It passed Pluto in, was it 6 years? I mean, it.
That's insane.
Yeah, and it's one of the smallest probes we've ever launched on one of the biggest rockets we've ever launched. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we just whipped it out there.
Yeah. So I guess to kind of wrap this up and to get to the crux of my questioning of this whole thing is... I'm always hearing about us sending more probes to Mars. And it's not just the United States. It's many countries are trying to get to Mars to land probes and things like that. It's like, we're already there. Yeah. We've got Mars kind of figured out. We've got a pretty decent idea, a base level understanding of what Mars is. Let's send some of those probes further out. Let's just keep going. It's like instead of sending another probe to Mars, let's send one to Neptune. Let's see, and send it out there with the same propulsion system, with the same ability to slow down and navigate to a landing, and then a little scoop that comes out and scoops up and sends back. You know, let's do that because I'm curious. I want to know.
You could. Communication lag will be terrible.
Well, okay.
Takes up to 20 minutes to Mars, man. I can only imagine
yeah.
how long it takes to communicate to planets beyond.
But you're a rocket scientist. You can figure that out. That's why you're sitting here, right?
Radio waves travel the same speed no matter where you are. Light still travels the speed of light.
I've got confidence in you, Bill. I have confidence in you, Bill. You can figure this out.
But still, it'd be cool. I agree. It would be cool. And it just have a little more time because New Horizons, at that speed it was traveling, it got very little time on Pluto, right? It's flying by at a yeah. tremendous speed. And you're like, you better get those cameras whirring because you've got a very limited time
yeah.
for your science mission.
It's like, here comes Pluto. There goes Pluto. Son of a... I blinked. All right. Okay. So, Rena, hopefully our ramblings helped answer that question for you. Hope you feel a little bit smarter because I definitely do. I always do when I sit down with Bill. Speaking of which, okay, as we wrap up the show, let's think about what are things that we learned. What did we learn today, Bill? We learned that 2001 was pretty scientifically accurate. Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick.
They tried and actually succeeded in a lot of their guesswork.
They put a lot of effort. I don't know if you're familiar with the movie. If you aren't, take a moment. It really is amazing.
Embrace the 60s.
But Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, they put the effort in. They weren't just screwing around. They weren't just like, oh, let's pretend it's this and this. Kubrick was like, no. I want it to be accurate. Arthur C. Clarke is, yeah, it's got to be as accurate as we can get it. We also learned that Bill will never travel into space.
No.
Ever, under any circumstances.
Not quite what I said.
Will you travel into space?
I still like to go to space.
Okay.
I didn't want to be an astronaut. Growing up, I always wanted to be one.
Okay, so I think we can nail down that Bill wants to go to space.
I'd just be a nervous traveler.
Yes. Oh, okay, great. So you're kind of like Mr. T on the old A-Team show. If we can knock you unconscious.
I'm there.
And get you on the ship so you wake up in orbit.
Right.
And then we also know that that it's just too expensive to travel the universe landing on all these little tiny moons and things.
But significantly cheaper if you want to go to 300,000 feet and experience the edge of space.
Yes, if we want to do that. So yeah, so the other thing that we learned is, you know, we'd travel to all the moons of Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus. You say Uranus or Uranus? Because my goodness.
Sounds like a personal question, Chuck.
That word never fails to entertain.
Like snicker, snicker, snicker.
Exactly. So we could travel all of these places if they were all made out of gold or some kind of rich ore that we desperately needed here on Earth and we could make a boatload of cash. But once again, Bill, thanks for taking time and answering some of these questions. Sure to appreciate my opportunity and our listeners' opportunity to ask a rocket scientist. So if you want more information on some of the stuff that we talked about, I can't recommend highly enough the Blu-ray of 2001, A Space Odyssey. Seriously, pick it up. There's several behind-the-scenes documentaries on there. It really is fascinating.
Yep, space.com is a great one for all things space. Go figure. A lot of these companies have their own presence on the internet. Like you can go straight to Blue Origin, SpaceX, Boeing, Virgin Galactic, if you want to up on any of the commercial crew endeavors that we were talking about.
If you want to price a flight
actually,
to 300,000 feet, sure you can shop around. In fact, I think Groupon's got a coupon right now. You could travel, I think, Virgin Galactic for $175,000. Quite the steal. All right, Bill, thanks so much. We'll do this again next time. Thanks for listening to Ask a Rocket Scientist. And hey, don't forget, you can hit our website, iHeartRocketScience. If you've got any questions, anything you want to toss into the conversation, we've got little discussion threads there. You can add to whatever we've talked about. You can tell us how wrong we are. All that stuff at our website, iHeartRocketScience.com. This episode of Ask a Rocket Scientist couldn't happen without the help of Lee Damschroeder. He's the guy that wrote this awesome tune you're listening to, and he did the intro as well. And also Marlon, the cat. Where would we be without our furry feline? Hey, if you'd like to advertise on the show, we're not above that. We'll definitely take your advertising. You can reach us at our website, iHeartRocketScience.com. Find us there.